You're tuned in to WMSC in Milwaukee, and I'm on the line with Mark Mothersbaugh, co-founder of the band Devo. Mark is scheduled to be in Milwaukee on June 21st at KM Art Studios, located at 226 South 1st Street. KM Art is proud to present an exhibit of the artwork of Mark Mothersbaugh. Hi, Mark. I'm sure you hear this a lot, but I just have to say I am a longtime fan of your music with Devo and your work at Mutato Musica, and I want to really thank you for taking the time to chat with us here in Milwaukee.
Oh, it's my pleasure.
I'm glad to hear that. Well, okay, let's see. I got a lot of questions here, but I'll start with some important ones. I know you were an art student at Kent State University when you co-founded Devo. Are you a musician foremost and then an artist, or do you feel that they both go hand in hand for you?
Well, I grew up on people like Andy Warhol. I was influenced by all the people that were more interested in ideas first and then how to execute them second. And so that's actually why Devo ended up, we were doing films and doing our own choreography and our own stages and our own album covers, and we did everything ourselves because we were about concepts and ideas first and foremost. So I don't really think of them as separate. I think of it all coming from the same place.
Mm-hmm. Kind of the whole thing. Yeah. What type of music or groups influenced you that gave, you know, Devo its unique sound?
That influenced Devo?
Yeah, or like kind of what did you listen to as, you know, just growing up, and, you know, what type of music was influential to you?
You know, we heard everything that everybody heard in the world. You know, it's like everything from the Beatles to elevator and supermarket music. I was always, and Dennis music. I always knew something bad was going to happen when I heard that soft, soporific music in the dentist office. I knew that there was going to be a little bit of Novocaine and then some pain. So, you know, everything influenced us. You know, TV commercials, we were up interested in just the subversive nature of capitalism and entertainment industry. And so, you know, we listened to Island of Lost Souls, the movie. We'd record the soundtrack on my answering machine for my telephone, because I didn't have a VCR back in those days, and we'd listen to the soundtrack later on, and those are the kind of things that influenced us, everything.
Great. Wow. I suppose you felt like a little, also too, an island being in Akron, Ohio. Like, for example, on your Easy Listening disc, you show a little drawing, you know, the bridge all the way to Los Angeles and Ohio being where it's at. I take it you felt rather limited where you were at?
Well, it was just that, you know, and not unlike Milwaukee, but, you know, this is before the Internet, and these were days when you know, you'd read Crawdaddy magazine or Rolling Stone magazine, and you'd see pictures of Haight-Ashbury or the Strip in Los Angeles or the Village in New York, or, you know, Carnaby Street in London, and you'd go, man, things are happening there. And then you'd go to downtown Akron, and there'd be, like, workers, like, trudging out single file out of big, draconian-looking factories and, you know, covered with soot on their way across the street to just get a drink so they could try and forget what they just had to do the last 8.5 hours. Mm-hmm. So it was not lost on us that we knew about everything that was going on. We had TV and we had radio and we could hear about what was happening around the world. We just knew that Akron, Ohio wasn't at the center of it.
I see. How do you feel right now that your music has influenced people? Do you see music as a vehicle for social change? And do you feel that you've accomplished that with Devo?
You know, we did what we could. You know, because it cuts both ways, and it is... It's a unwieldy, complicated machine to get involved with. You know, at best, the artists I like the best are the ones that can walk the line between commercial art and fine art and be a success in both areas. People like David Bowie or even David Byrne, and people that had content like Bob Dylan. That was the artist that intrigued me the most. And I think at our best, we did. I think we had a good influence on our culture at our best. And at our worst, we were benign. We were we were often misunderstood and ridiculed, and you know, it was easier for people to listen to what we were talking about and dismiss it than it was to oftentimes to be inspired by it.
I see. Well, with that in mind, and even from what you're talking about, your influences of what you did in your early years with music, why do you feel that people respond emotionally to music? I suppose what I'm trying to say is, do you see healing power in music, or to change people?
Sure. I mean, we considered ourselves musical reporters when we were in our early 20s and we were first writing music. We were writing about the things we saw around us and the things that were, you know, that we were concerned about. And I think the time period that Devo came along in, we had just been through the early 70s, and it was like kind of a constipated time in America and kind of in the world. The culture was just in a state of constipation, and the music that was happening when Devo came about, some of the bands that we felt kindred spirits to, and if there were any, and us, we were kind of more like we were like the enema bag for that culture.
Mm-hmm.
So I think we had a definite medicinal purpose.
Yeah, I'm glad to hear that, and I'm glad you also took the challenge, especially when I hear those early recordings, in the 75, 76, where you're getting heckled, and obviously from what I hear, it sounds like people are throwing stuff on stage, you know, for you to get off.
Yeah, we were a lightning rod for hostility, but, you know, mm-hmm. you could kind of liken it to the chimpanzees and their plight in Planet of the Apes. If you remember the chimpanzees who were, you know, had a quest for and an interest in knowledge and in evolving the species and going to the highest possible level the species was capable of, while the general ape and gorilla population was interested in, you know, control and pain and power on the most basest, stupidest level. Not unlike our culture these days. Gorillas are in control again.
Is that the concept of Devo de-evolution then?
We were sort of reporting the news of things falling apart. And back in the day, you know, you'd say, well, we're looking around at the world and we're seeing technology having a negatory effect on humans. We're seeing humans being conspicuous consumers and not cognizant of what their responsibilities to the planet are, and people would say, you know what, you guys just have a bad attitude. You guys don't know what you're talking about, you know. But nowadays you say something about de-evolution and people just laugh and shrug their shoulders and go, yeah, sure is devolving, isn't it? They don't even go devolving; they go, it's devolved, you know. People just kind of agree with you. You know, there's enough jackass both on the air and in control of your life that you know, there's no avoiding it.
Mm-hmm. Well, it seems throughout your career too, you've had the freedom to express yourself as a group and taken that step beyond. I recall in the early videos in the Men Who Make the Music, you described the music industry as taking you to the top while flushing your career down the drain, and you wouldn't know the difference. Was that commented directed to your relationship with Warner Brothers at the time?
Well, I mean, at the time we were signed to both Virgin Records in Europe, and we were signed over here to Warner Brothers, and it had been reamed by Stiff Records, who we let release three of our singles that we recorded in a basement in Akron, Ohio, in Europe, and out of those three singles, they had five songs that all went into the top 20 somewhere in Europe. Some of them went number one, before we had a record deal, and they never paid us a cent for any of the music they released. So that movie you're referring to was filled with real-life quotes from people that are still powerful people in the industry, you know, that it was lost on them what they were saying. They thought we were foolish artists that needed to be educated about how things work in the real world, and so, but we remembered all their quotes and used them in that movie. MTV hadn't happened yet when we made that film, if chronologically I'm correct. We were making these films anticipating music television. We just unfortunately it happened in a way that was not as noble as we were hoping for. We thought it was going to be an important art form that would put to death all the dinosaurs that were happening in rock and roll at the time. But unfortunately, record companies saw it as a way to just create a home network shopping center for pop music, and so the Devos of the world were pretty much quickly weeded out of MTV. Although we started at MTV and you know, in the first couple of years, you'd see a Devo video every hour because we were the only people that had 20 videos when they started. It turned into something else. It turned into baby pictures for record companies quickly.
Exactly. So I guess we won't. I don't even think MTV's ever aired that with Daddy Know It All, Rod Rooter, the whole.
No. They would. That's not in their best interest, and nor is it something that they would even pay attention to.
Mm-hmm.
It's like we were making these films back in a time when we were just hoping for something to come along that would some way to show them. And there were other artists, although in retrospect you think of early MTV as ZZ Top and Tom Petty and Madonna, that wasn't really, and Whitesnake, stuff like that. That there were artists at that time that nobody's ever heard of, Tone Set and other bands from around the United States that were making audio video. They were making sound and picture, artwork, and they just kind of got squelched by big business.
Did you feel okay? So with that in mind, you felt Warner Brothers was in a way trying to squelch you as far as from your creativity.
Well, they weren't interested in us. They didn't want what we were talking about to become popular. They had too much money invested in Prince and Madonna and Van Halen to look for other art bands that had content. They weren't interested in content.
Yeah. Well, what surprised me from Warner, with the CD revolution in the around 85, I was really surprised that Warner did not release CDs of your albums, New Traditionalist, Oh No, It's Devo. I purchased them over in Japan on Warner International, but it wasn't until Virgin and Infinite Zero started releasing, Shout and all your classic albums, and I really could not understand why Warner didn't distribute right here in the USA and only in Japan.
Well, because music industry wasn't and isn't about art, It's if art happens, it's usually an accident. You know what I mean?
Yeah,
I mean, look
exactly.
At most of the artists that are successful, even today. Look at who's successful and who the predominant list of people that are popular. It's not artists.
Yeah.
They're trained monkeys that work for the corporation.
Exactly. I guess I was referring from a money standpoint. I was really surprised they at least didn't distribute some units. And, at least even in the mid-80s, you had a large following of Devo fans, and it just surprised me they didn't distribute more. But
that both worked for us and against us.
Mm-hmm.
Because before we had done the song Whip It, our record company just said, oh, they're this weird art band we have signed, and they never go in the red. They're always in the black because they don't spend a lot of money, and they're careful about things, and they do everything themselves, so we don't have to hire other people, So they're just, they're just our art band over there in the corner there. And they just pretty much ignored us, and then after Whip It happened, then we had the president of the record company, start lurking around the studio while we were doing the next album, and he even came in and sat down at the mixing console. He was gonna make sure that we had didn't matter what we did, as long as we did another whippet. That's what he said.
Mm-hmm.
And we saw him sit down there at the console, and kind of, you know, we knew it was the beginning of the end in a way, because from that point on, they didn't leave us alone, and were.
It's kind of sad.
You know, they censored what was coming out, because then they smell, once they smell money, then it's like they have a whole nother interest.
Yeah. Well, I mean, you definitely rock the music industry with design, innovative music, and I, in my teenage years, I used to go crazy waiting for the release of the next album, you know, because every album to me was a departure from your last style, you know, I mean, that's what, I'm so glad you stepped out of the norm, you know, with everything, and that's why, like, you know, from Freedom of Choice to New Traditionalist, it was almost like totally different. It's like seeing a new band, a different style, new presentation, visual, music-wise, and I just love that. That's really what I enjoyed about Devo. And as far as the design and everything, are you solely responsible for the artwork and fashions on those Devo?
No, both Jerry Casale and my brother and I. It was collaborative. It was two sets of brothers, really. It was the two Casales and the two Mothersbaughs, and. Mm-hmm. And Jerry and I met at Kent State. We were in art school, and we were both fine artists, and we both kind of experimented in music, and he was in a blues band at the time, and I had, like, this kind of weird, I don't know what you'd call it, it was like some acid, I was into synthesizers and electronic music, and I was doing kind of like, I was like doing more experimental stuff, and it was when they shot students at our mm-hmm. school. They closed down the campus, and so we ended up getting together. Instead of going to school every day, we got together over at my place and wrote music. And you know, we thought of what we were doing. Him bringing in like a blues and kind of beat oriented thing, and me kind of being more like kind of I don't know, spacey or more interested in like mortar blasts and V2 rocket sounds. We kind of were like Flintstones meet the Jetsons or something, and so our music is kind of primitive futurism,
mm-hmm.
and that's how it started for us. And we still mm-hmm. did visual art, because we did our album covers, we did all our ads and all the merchandising and all the stupid little icons, the red hats and the black mm-hmm. pompadours and the yellow suits. We designed all that ourselves, so we were doing mm-hmm. visuals the whole time. And
so I guess they did go hand in hand, both art, music, the whole thing.
Yeah,
like
it
whole
did for us. I mean, you know, the majority of the bands that have videos on MTV, they have nothing to do with the concept of the video or the making of it, other than to show up as actors in it.
Mm-hmm.
Whereas, you know, we did everything. We directed them. We mm-hmm. were the picture editors. We were the gaffers, we were the lighting people, we were the prop masters, we went out and found locations, and we did the whole thing ourselves, kind of Little Rascal style.
Was it the group's idea, as far as when the new releases of the albums came out, the Inner Sleeve had the order form to...
Oh, yeah. Matter of fact, our manager at the time said that he also managed Neil Young, and he goes, Neil thinks it's not cool, man, that you guys are... selling, you know, T-shirts with your name on them. And I'm like, well, we think of it as like Cracker Jack toys in a box. When we were kids, what got us excited was like finding, you know, like the prize in a box of cereal and ordering stuff off of the, you know, we didn't care that Neil Young thought it was uncool that we were selling. Of course, now he sells everything under the sun. But, you know, we were just kind of, we were into it. We liked kind of the blurring of fine art and commercial art.
Well, it was also a unique thing. I mean, come on, a yellow jumpsuit that you can order and the spud ring collar and all that.
Why those yellow suits would be handy now if you were on an airplane traveling to Hong Kong or something, and you could help you with dealing with those weird infections that are out there in the world.
Exactly.
It is a hostile world now, you know.
It sure enough is. And, you know, in reference to that, you described the, you know, the work on your cards as...
When I come to Milwaukee, I'm probably going to wear a yellow suit on if they let me on the plane with it on.
Have you ever rode
Might
on the plane?
Might be safer.
On your Recombo DNA album, there is a picture of you of the band with the yellow suits, you know, in the booklet. I don't know. You're wearing the suit, so you actually did board the plane as a group in those yellow suits.
Yeah, I've had to wear them before. I remember we used to when we were doing big tours. I remember a couple times we'd set our suitcases out in front of the door at 3 a.m. so that the roadies would get them on the plane, so that we could get on a plane at 6 a.m. and then fly to the next town. And I remember more than once, people in the band would come back to their room after the show, get undressed, put all their stuff in their suitcase and set it out, and then realize the next morning that they'd packed every piece of clothing they had, so they'd end up wearing their yellow suit by necessity.
I'm so glad you guys weren't shy about that. I even like on your Hardcore Diva, there's a picture of you guys in the bus stop, wearing the jumpsuits.
Yeah.
That is so awesome. I love that.
Although picture. I do have to say, I think the first couple buses just passed us by and didn't stop that day. That was 1976,
And not to mention the people, looking at that photo is so funny. There's one lady snickering, looking at you guys, and then another lady just sitting there looking straight ahead, like ignoring you.
Mm-hmm.
And
she was playing hard to get.
Okay. Oh, I guess I'll just leave that one in where it is. okay. You lost me a little on that. Okay.
Join the crowd then.
Yeah. Going back to your artwork, you do describe your work, from when I was looking at your website, as one man's view on his culture. In this post 9/11, period with terrorism, the war, SARS, mm-hmm. has your artwork changed in any way as a result?
Yeah, I think so. I mean, actually, the artwork in this show was kind of, there's a lot of influence from both pre 9/11 and post 9/11, just the gap between, the East and the West, and the haves and the have-nots. It's just a bunch of snapshots of, somebody that comes to work every day, writes music for a living, and they draw pictures while the engineer is getting the orchestra set up for the next piece of music. And the whole thing of people, and especially the women that are doing that strap things onto themselves so that they can go blow themselves up and take somebody else out with them. Very curious about the whole thing. It's both frightening and sad, and on another side, it'd make a great TV show if you could get the sitcom rights for that. Everybody could blow themselves up every episode. It's kind of a world gone crazy right now.
These postcards that you have, I guess you've been doodling now, it says it's been in the making for 30 years, and they've been rarely available to the public. Although I do recall in the release of your Music for Insomniacs, Volumes 1 and 2, you made your book available, What I Know, to
mm-hmm.
Volume 1. Can one still buy this book?
I think there was only 3,000 or something printed. There weren't very many printed, and the woman who printed it, she was a manic depressive and eventually committed suicide. But before that, she took about 1,000 of the copies and locked them in her garage and wouldn't talk to distributors or anybody. And I don't know what happened when she died, what happened to the books. I think they just probably all got shoveled into the trash. Because she had a bunch of books. She had some Henry Rollins books that she had taken hostage to. I don't know. It was a weird experience. It was, a mixed experience.
Have you ever released a volume 2? Of What I Know?
No, I made a volume 2, 3, and 4, and they never got released. This woman put me off of it for a really long time, so I'm just now getting to the point where I don't think about it and shudder.
So from the time the What I Know book, when you did bring that out, this is up to where we are now. This is the only time you've ever released your artwork?
I've done shows, and I've done some tours in the 80s, and mostly just sporadic things, because about 7 years ago I started a company here called Mutato Musica, and it was kind of a life after rock and roll kind of place where I just was doing music. Actually, a few years earlier, and that's been about 10 years now. And started doing music for TV and film and games and interactive stuff and corporate. War songs and, interrogation music and whoever, just got offered all these odd, interesting jobs and some of them were good, some of them you got there and started doing it and you felt like you had been slimed for working on it. But it's been an interesting journey. But that kind of took my focus away from doing visual art. I'd been doing visual art and doing tours with people like Robert Williams before that for a while. With the California lowbrow artists kind of took me in about 15 years ago and let me do shows with them. And then I lost interest for a while, and then just recently I started printing again here at my studio. I have a couple rooms set up as art rooms, and so now I'm able to write music and work on the artwork that goes into these shows at the same time. So,
well, the artwork is very colorful, bright, animated, and then suddenly the lady is wearing antlers or something twisted. Can you elaborate on this type of style and what inspired you to get these ideas?
From a style standpoint, it's amoral in the sense that the only thing that stays consistent is that it starts off on postcard-sized paper, you know, like about 3.5 by 5.5 to 4 by 6. And then it goes from there. It goes into, you know, sometimes I paint or then I do some work in Photoshop on it and then print it out and then draw on top of it again or whatever. But the subject matter is kind of, it's like the ruminations of a concerned citizen of planet Earth. And so sometimes it's more senile than others, and sometimes it's more poignant than others, you know. Mm-hmm. And it all gets thrown in the same place, and then I go through it and pick out the ones that are the least embarrassing and could possibly have some remote interest to other bystanders that might walk into an art gallery, and that's how it gets chosen for the show.
I see.
There's about, you know, you talk about the book What I Know. There, in the last 30 years, there's been 220 volumes of postcards that are on a shelf at my house now. There's 225. Matter of fact, they made the bookshelf fall down yesterday, 2 days ago. So I came home to see the bookshelf in a crash. I had to go pick all the books up again.
So this is a result of, say, just instead of twiddling your thumbs, you just doodle. I mean, just to...
Well, you... thank you for using the word doodle. You know, but, yeah, that's what it is. I guess doodle. I hope it doesn't say doodle on my website. But you've said doodle twice
well,
now. So
I think
to,
that is... it does say that.
It does? Then I'm going to kill the guy who wrote that.
Well, I think what they said is, you know, 30 years in the making as a result. I think they did say that from doodling.
He said doodling? That little... Well, that's that Michael Pilmer. He thinks he calls it doodling. Well, now I have to start paying attention to my own website.
Yeah, okay.
You can't just let stuff happen with your name on it, you know. Well, it'd be like, what if Orville Redenbacher just let anything go into his... Of course, he's dead now, so he can't can't do anything about it. Or Jimmy Dean's sausages. Who knows? They might be sweeping up scrapings off the floor and stuffing them in sausage if he doesn't hang out at the factory now and then.
There you go. Yeah. This is what a quick question here. Mutato Musica, it's located in Los Angeles. Do you feel that's a perfect breeding ground in this country for Mutato Musica to evolve and mutate?
You know what? L.A.'s okay.
Well, it seems like a Devo-friendly town, I guess. Just it seems like K-Rock radio station promoted that Devo-Tees album in the early years.
There were some people that caught on to what we were doing, but that's because we came out here. I think I don't think L.A. is any cooler than anywhere else, to be honest with you. I think there's probably more interesting people that are untapped in Madison than there are here, or in Milwaukee than there are here, or in, you know, Canton, Ohio, for that matter, than there are here. I mean, anybody that's slightly interesting gets tapped for something here. It's just that the business is here, and that's the only reason why I'm here. Physically, I need the internet to become more plastic and more flexible and more usable in my industry so that I can get the hell out of here.
Mm-hmm. And that's kind of how you chose these small art studios, such as KMR, to display your work, as opposed to a more...
Well, you know how I chose this? I got to tell you, it's had a lot to do with Juxtapose magazine, and also it's people that choose me, because my art isn't the kind that lawyers buy for their offices or banks buy for their corporate portfolio. You know, my art's kind of odd, and it appeals mostly to more idealistic, more idea friendly age groups, and it's usually young adults that are like right in between. You know, they just left, you know, like high school, and they're like in the world going, wait a minute, this is a bunch of shit. You know, those are the people that like my art the best. And so I've tried to look for so I'm not interested in showing at Tony Shafrazi. He doesn't care about me, nor even know who I am, I'm sure. Tony Shafrazi or James Corcoran or any of the big galleries. You know who knows who I am? It's people that you know, like, still have Devo records, or they found them in a bargain bin and they pulled them out, or they pay attention to credits in movies and they go, who does the music for the Wes Anderson stuff? You know, it's people like that that are kind of interested in my artwork, you know. And so I'm looking for galleries that are smaller, that are usually the galleries that I'm showing, and they maybe advertise in Juxtapose magazine, but they're usually like more cutting edge. They're people that are interested in taking a chance. Their clientele isn't going to be lawyers and bankers. It's going to be college students and people that are on a budget. So I've priced the artwork accordingly. I've made the artwork very affordable. It's like, I hate to say it, but I found a framing company out in the valley here, and I got some deal because I'm framing a couple, like about 300 or 400 pieces for all these shows. And so they gave me a price that was so cheap, it's like you could almost just go buy one of my pieces, pull the artwork out, throw it away, and then put your own artwork in, and it's cheaper than going to buy a frame somewhere. It's kind of, I hate to say it, but it's kind of true, because I got these deals, and I'm just selling it for... I'm trying, you know, it's like, it's called Homefront Invasion because my interest with this show is to invade people's homes, is to get my artwork in there so that they might wake up in the morning and look over and see something that I drew on the day of 9/11 or something I drew on my birthday or on the day we had an orchestra in here at the studio. It's
reflective of whatever your mood was at the time.
Yeah,
at the
so
moment.
that's what that's about.
As far musically, artistically, are you most at home when you're creating music or art, or say doing a musical score for a movie or TV show?
You know, different things kind of get you excited or interested, you know, and it can be a feature film, or it can be sitting in bed with my fiance with a postcard. You know, it's all part of the same ribbon of my part of time, you know.
I see. From years past, like you did the music score for Pee-wee's Playhouse, movies like The Last Supper. Is this something that you sought out to do, or they came to you?
Well, it was something I always had an interest in. I mean, I told you that Devo collected film scores, you know, back in the early 70s. And, you know, it's like songs like Jocko Homo was directly influenced by Island of Lost Souls, you know, the Charles Laughton movie. Mm-hmm. More conceptually than musically, but I think we always had it. You know, we parodied ourselves. We did commercials of ourselves. We were interested in... We did scores for our little films, you know, like the one you were talking about, the long-form movie we did. We wrote our own scores for that. So we never saw ourselves as... I don't think we thought of ourselves as pop songwriters, you know. It just... We just kind of... We were that, and we were a bunch of other things, too. And still kind of... Still kind of fits that way.
So your battles with the music industry and so forth, right now do you feel you have the freedom of creativity to do really what you want and express yourself?
Oh yeah. You know, that's the interesting thing about TV and film is you don't have, I mean, pop music, you know, like the music that you generally, if you turn on MTV, it's pretty limited everything sounds like everything else, you know, with like really small differences. You know, people go into genres and then they stay there and they want you to stay there. It's like I have, you know, I have an anonymity now that I can work with a jazz quintet on Tuesday for like a Welcome to Collinwood movie, or I can work with a synth sextet for the movie 13, or I can work with a 90-piece orchestra for Rugrats, and it's all happening in the same 3 weeks. It's not like, you know, where when you're in a band, you write 12 songs for an album, then you make a video for one of them, and then you go on tour for 6 months, and you're still playing the same songs, and then you get to add a couple new songs to it, you know, a year later when you're off the tour. You know, this is much more about creativity, I think, what I get to do now.
That's great. I guess one of the last times I recall Devo being together as a group was during the Lollapalooza concert. Will Devo fans across the country or the world ever get a chance to see the original members perform on stage again?
We still play.
What are you doing?
We have just a couple shows we're doing next month. We're doing some festivals in Japan, and we're doing a couple California shows, and we almost did something in Chicago and almost did something in Cleveland, and I think they both fell through, so it's not going to happen. But you know, we show up every now and then. We forget why it is we quit doing that and go out and do it again for a few weeks and then go, oh yeah, that's why we stopped doing it.
Can we expect a future Devo album?
There are some people in the band that would really like that to happen, and sometimes I join in with them and thinking that, and other times I'm like, you know what, there's other people that could be doing albums now. Let them do them.
You don't want to hang around as long as the Rolling Stones and just keep churning out CDs?
You know, I think bands are like viruses, and they have built-in lifespans and necessities, and I think as long as there's somebody else to say the things that Devo was saying, you know, if nobody comes along to fill our place, then maybe we have to get back out there again. But you know, it's like Rolling Stones, they were a really strong, they were more like bubonic plague or something, you know, like a lot of bands are like a 24-hour virus or less, you know, maybe a 15-minute virus. And, so they have one song and they did what they were supposed to do, you know. I don't think you want to have the 1910 Fruit Gum Company day in and day out still alive. It's kind of nice that they rest in your memory rather than that they keep continuing. And I think Devo, we did what we were supposed to do. So, you know, there are times when maybe it's, you know, maybe it'd be kind of fun to come out and do things. But I think we accomplished what we were supposed to accomplish. Maybe not everything that we tried to accomplish, but certainly probably what was in the cards for us to do. So, you know, it's not like if Devo never performed again, like the world would lose something incredible, you know. Mm. It's like you were at a Devo show, right?
Oh, I've been to, well, the 88 tour, the total Devo one. I was in Chicago and Detroit.
That was a good one. Well, you know what? That's you know, hey, that's you got the memory. That's good enough. Yeah. You don't have to relive that.
Exactly.
Ever again, really.
Well, you know, they're good memories. You're right, yeah. You know, if Devo was formed today, how different might your music have been?
We would probably wear burkas and have blown ourselves up by now.
Okay, I'll leave it there. So at this stage in your life, what goals and achievements are left to pursue?
I'm looking, you know what, from a movie standpoint, I'm hoping that before I'm out of this business, I get to do my To Kill a Mockingbird. I hope I get to do one really great, important, lasting film and get to do a score that is identified with that movie in a way that you can't separate them. That's what I'd like.
Yeah. That's great. Is that...
You know, Elmer Bernstein did an amazing job on that, and I would love to do something that in my own way was as good as that. I think the closest I've got so far is probably the Wes Anderson things. And we're certainly not ruling out his writing abilities or his movie-making abilities. So I'm on to the next movie with him already.
Great. Well, I hope that gets fulfilled. I can't think of anything else to say, Mark.
Other than that, I'd like to see peace in the central north, mid-north America. I'd like to see Wisconsin and Minnesota finally bury the hatchet and get along with each other.
Well, you know, that's what happens when borders are set. And I like you said, that's pretty much the world we live in. Mark, it has really been a pleasure interviewing you, and I'm glad you've given us the time to...
Well, it's been a pleasure getting to just to get to sit here and say my piece, so thank you for that.